Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to After Dark. Now this week, we need you to go through the sorting process at Hogwarts because today we are going to be learning all about the monsters and mayhem of creatures that infiltrate the magical world of Harry Potter.
The island is shrouded in darkness, its jagged cliffs battered relentlessly by the raging storm. Amid the tempest, the imposing jail fortress of Azkaban stands tall. Its towering walls a testament to the despair that lies within. Inside the fortress, a prisoner huddles in the corner of his cell, his thin robes offering little warmth. A bone-chilling cold creeps into the cell. He knows only too well what this means. A visit from one of Azkaban's guards. His cell door opens with a long creak. And in the doorway is the unmistakable shape of a Dementor. The prisoner's heart pounds with fear, his breaths shallow and ragged as the Dementor draws closer. The creature stops, towering above its prey. It pauses, then reaches up with a decaying skeletal hand and lowers its hood. At this moment, all hope flees from the prisoner's heart, replaced by a numbing despair and the embrace of the Dementor's kiss.
Welcome to After Dark. My name is Anthony.
And I'm Maddie.
And today joining us in After Dark Towers is Kerry Holbrook, who is our guest. Now, Kerry lectures in folklore and history at the University of Hertfordshire, and they have an incredible MA on folklore there. So this is right up our street in After Dark, as well as for this particular episode. And Kerry's debut novel, Winter's Wishfall, was published last October. Now, if you're joining us on YouTube, you will be able to see that there's a fourth person. I think this is the first time there's been a fourth person in the After Dark Studios. And we also have Tom, producer Tom, who is here with us today in After Dark Towers. And he's usually sitting in the other room watching and making sure that we're not doing anything ridiculous or he's editing out all our mistakes. But today he has joined us in the studio. And Tom is a committed Potterhead. This is what it says in my notes, Tom. So I'm just going to say it.
That is my official job title.
And he has also produced this episode. So apparently, and the three of us, myself, Kerry, and Tom, do not know what this is. Maddie has some secret information. And we are kicking off with my blood is running cold. We are kicking off with a quiz. Okay, let's brace ourselves.
We're about to find out.
How do we let you know if how do we answer? Like, we don't have buzzers.
I was going to say raise your hand, but this is primarily a podcast.
We'll say our names.
Shout your name out. Yeah, sure, okay. Absolutely. Okay,
I'm
so
lose, just
this
so you know.
This is a quiz about Harry Potter. We're going to find out who is a real fan, who is not.
Oh,
so I'm looking at you.
Here. He knows. I've read all the books, but it's been a while. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Question number one. What kind of creature has eight eyes, eight legs with a span of up to 15 feet and highly toxic venom worth 100 galleons a pint in 1996?
Tom
is immediately
Do I say my
in
name?
There.
Okay, Tom.
Shout your own name. Why not?
It's an acromantula.
It is.
Oh, I was
it
say
is.
The big spider. I
That's
don't
what
know.
It is. Yeah,
yeah, well, I know, but you need to give the proper things. Yeah,
I'll give you half a point, Anthony.
No, I can't. Don't give me pity points.
If you can name the big spider in Harry Potter.
Ooh, Hagrid likes him and he takes pity on him. No, I'm never going to remember. What is it, Tom?
It's Aragog.
Very good it is, that, yes. Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Question number two. What kind of dragon is Norbert?
Tom
is on it again. Tom, go on.
This is how this quiz is going. Okay, Tom.
Okay. Is it a Norwegian Ridgeback?
That is correct.
Ding, ding, ding,
Another
ding,
point
ding,
to
ding,
Tom. Ding. Yeah. Okay, next question. What creature attacked Fleur Delacour during the second task of the Triwizard Tournament?
Oh my God.
Described as a small, horned water demon.
I'm out on this one. I have no idea.
Kerry's,
Harry?
Go for it.
Is it a Grindylow?
It is. Brilliant. Point to Kerry. God. Well done.
I told you I'm losing.
You've read these books.
I have. No, I have terrible memory, though.
Okay. Which animal's egg do you need to create a basilisk?
Tom.
Oh, no.
You go for
Guess who didn't try it.
Okay. I feel Terry was slightly... Terry.
Terry is the amalgamation of both.
Kerry was slightly quicker there, I'm afraid. Kerry, go on.
A rooster.
I've got a chicken.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty close. Tom, what were you going to say?
I was going to say a chicken. Oh. But I think that's the point.
You can share the point. You can share the point.
It's just a chicken's egg, though. Wait, this is...
What came first? The chicken, the egg, or the basilisk?
Okay, hold on. No, let's not delve too much into this. Okay, go. Yeah.
Don't question.
No. Yeah.
Okay, final question. Which magical beast lures travellers off their paths at night into treacherous bogs and wetlands?
Here.
See, this is making me think... of Lord of the Rings when the hobbits
oh, I can't
and Gollum
remember that
aren't.
Either
oh god right we have some reading
we need to have
to
a
do.
Spice One, Girls quiz someday
yes.
Somebody I'll get all of those questions but anyway sorry
that is true.
Read that question again not that I know the answer but
which magical
might.
Beast lures travellers off their paths at night into treacherous bogs and wetlands
I wanted
J.K. Rowling
whoa
no okay no sorry
shots fired
I guessed
Tom
go on
I really don't is it like a red cap or a hinky punk or something?
It is a hinky punk.
Shut up. A hinky
punk. Encyclopedic knowledge.
A
absolutely outstanding.
I have no idea what it looks like. I've just heard it. I remember.
Hinky punk.
Nice. And there concludes the Harry Potter quiz.
Can we get a blitz tally, please?
Yeah,
can we tally
them
up?
Oh, she wasn't keeping score.
I think on minus 1,000 is Dr. Anthony Delaney.
Thank you. That PhD in Harry Potter was a waste
quickly, of I think second place with probably saying Kerry.
I
think no surprises. Tom, our resident Potterhead, has won the quiz. Well done.
No, it's settled. It's fixed.
Thank you.
Get out, Tom.
Get out.
No, I mean that in the nicest way possible. Tom needs to go back to producing now.
Okay.
So let's talk about some of these animals, these creatures, these monsters that we've had a little bit of hint of in the quiz. We're joined by Kerry Holbrook. Kerry, welcome to After Dark.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You're very welcome.
Sorry I did so badly in that quiz. Really, really let the side down.
Yeah, I feel like...
Oh, wait, Tom's on the History Hit side, so Tom didn't let the side down. Anyway, look, this is good because now I get to brush up on the things I knew nothing about.
So, Kerry, before we get into some of these monsters, I'm so fascinated by the fact that you lecture in folklore, amongst many other things. That seems... like a rare thing to teach at a UK university? Is there growing interest in this in higher education?
There is growing interest, actually. So it is the only one in England. There's some in Scotland and Wales and Ireland. And it's interesting because folklore is essentially an English creation in terms of the term. English scholars have been studying folklore for 100 years. And it just feels like now is a really good time to be interested in it because suddenly kind of heritage places and writers and movie makers are all interested in folklore and magic and monsters.
And podcasts.
And podcasts, yeah. And
like
podcasts,
this one.
Yep.
Can I ask, is it being fed, do you think, that interest being fed by things like Harry Potter? Has that, because that generation is now in their 20s, 30s, okay, they've probably gone through uni the first cycle, but they're still coming up. Do you think these type of books have really informed interest in that?
I think so, because every year we have students who love Harry Potter. Normally have quite a big debate. There are some who hate Harry Potter and then some who absolutely love it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely still on people's radar and it's definitely informing children's knowledge of magic and creatures. So, yeah.
Mm. What's your relationship to Harry Potter, Kerry?
I'm his cousin.
You know him personally.
Right. I devoured it when I was a child. Absolutely loved it. So it definitely informed my interest. And now I have a little boy who loves it. So yeah, I'm still, I wouldn't say I'm nowhere near as good as Tom. I don't know it inside out.
That might not be a bad thing.
But yeah, no, I enjoy the magical world that's created, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive a little bit deeper into that. So in the narrative at the beginning of this episode, we heard about the Dementors at Azkaban. Now, I have always assumed that they have some kind of folkloric origin, some roots in other stories beyond Harry Potter, but they are actually an invention of J.K. Rowling, is that right?
Yeah, so some of the creatures come from folklore directly, and some are inventions. The Dementors are interesting because they are drawing on imagery from folklore and myth, but they are a J.K. Rowling invention. And I think that she's been quite upfront about them representing a time when she was depressed. And, you know, she used those feelings and the effects of depression to create these creatures, which are essentially a combination of the terms tormentor and dement. So already the terminology represents something quite dark. But in terms of what they're kind of where they've come from in the imagination, there are so many folkloric creatures who kind of are dark, shrouded in darkness, suck the life, suck the soul out of people. Some are quite specific. So Native American Choctaws have the Impishaloop, who are dark, cloaked beings who come and suck the life out of anybody who's feeling depressed. So actually quite resonates there. Mm-hmm. But then you have vampires, succubus, all these supernatural creatures who just suck the life energy out of people. So yeah, there is a lot of history and folklore that she's drawing on in the creation.
Can I just ask, is that unusual in terms of the formation of a folkloric trope, in that we have such a personal connection to the author there about their own experiences of depression and that translating then into the novel? I would imagine that given the kind of deep roots of folklore, it's very difficult to pinpoint another folkloric invention to such a specific person and emotion.
Yeah, it's interesting that we can really make that link explicitly, because the author, the creator of that creature, has told us for the vast majority of folkloric creatures, we have no idea of the origins and we've stopped trying.
Yes, yeah.
It's really fascinating to have. I mean, I know that it's a fictional creation, but it has entered folklore. So, yeah.
You talk there, Kerry, about vampires and succubuses and this idea of sucking someone's soul or their energy, their happiness out of them. But with the Dementors, it's specifically a kiss. And in the films, and indeed in the book, the sort of mouth of the Dementor is this thing that's shrouded and kept hidden until the last moment. What do you think is going on there in terms of the kiss? Is that something that we see elsewhere? Can we compare it to something like a vampire sucking blood from someone's neck, say, or someone's wrist? Is it a similar idea? There's something about human mouths or the mouths of animals. Is there any resonance there?
Yeah, I think the mouth is really connected to soul eaters in folklore. The succubus kisses and sucks the energy and the life source out of the victim through the kiss. So yeah, I do wonder whether that was partly her inspiration.
Yeah, and it seems so unsympathetic, these creatures, in the context of the Harry Potter story, that they are kissing people who are condemned to die, or rather condemned to lose their soul, let's say. Prisoners, people who've supposedly committed crimes. And there's something so intimate about a kiss in most cultures across the globe, and a sort of a kindness associated with that. And it's the sort of inverse here, which I find fascinating.
It's reminding me as well that when we speak about those kind of early days of the author starting out on the journey of writing these books, we know that there is links to domestic violence. We know that there's links to people, men specifically, coming into a space where they belittle and they take away and cost you something, and to a certain extent, sure, metaphorically, but a life to a certain extent. And that kiss, that intimacy, that proximity to the person, and then the cause, of course, being a depression or a depressive feeling, is also a very human thing as well, mm-hmm. that people can occupy these spaces, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very personal, it's very human, it's very intimate. And yeah, to turn it around into something that's so threatening, yeah, maybe yeah. we can see another link there to the author. Mm. I also think it's interesting the way you tackle a dementor is with a happy memory, so drawing on the happy memory and chocolate.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that really a thing, chocolate, in the books?
After you've kind of encountered a dementor, having a bit of chocolate helps to recover.
Professor Lupin nice. Gives Harry chocolate when he passes out after being saved from a dementor.
I wish I could remember, but yes, well done.
There we go.
No, right, but that's really human in its... Mm.
And silly, right? It's a kind of silliness, and that may be as well, thinking about J.K. Rowling's obvious inheritances from other children's literature. Think of something like Willy Wonka or, you know, a Roald Dahl story where chocolate is fun, it's silly, it's a form of rebellion against an oppressive outside world, you know. That's so interesting. Let's move on now and talk about another creature from the books. I want to talk about thestrals. Now, Kerry, can you just give us an idea of what this creature looks like? We do have a picture that I'm going to make Anthony describe, but can you just give us a sense of what these are, how they operate in the Harry Potter world?
Yep, so these are another Rowling invention, and they are horse-like creatures that are only visible to people who've witnessed death.
By that, is the distinction witness somebody at the point of life leaving them or seen a body?
That's an interesting question, actually.
Yeah.
I
would say, I'm trying to think of the characters who can see them, and I would say they've all witnessed deaths.
The point of death,
right. I would say, okay. rather than a body, potentially.
Do you want me to describe this thing?
Yeah, before we get into them, describe. So this is a piece of fan art that we've got. Tom's very kindly dug this up for us. So Anthony,
I recognize it from the film. So essentially, the basis is a horse, but skeletal. There is probably flesh on there, but it's essentially bone and sinew, and, you know, it's not a fleshy horse. It has like the tail of a big cat almost. It's quite whip-like. I say it's horse-like, and it is, but the face, the head is slightly distorted into something that's even more angular. Seems to have even little horns, although they might be ears, on top of the head. And then, of course, the striking thing is these huge dragon-like wings that have the thumb of a claw sticking out from one of the wings. It's like bat wings for all intents and purposes, just huge. I didn't realize that she invented these as well. I think I knew about the Dementors, but this is, in some ways... These are so visually striking. Mind you, the Dementors are too. And they do seem to sit in the same world, but they're actually quite different from what I remember, right? These aren't purely bad.
No. Because they're connected with death in that they're only visible to someone who's witnessed it, they're seen as kind of bad omens. But really, it's just how they are.
Yeah.
And I think that Hagrid makes that distinction that, you know, they have a bad reputation. Even though they're carnivorous, which is a distinction with horses.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not bad creatures.
One thing that has always fascinated me about these, and I found thestrals to be the most moving part of the books, actually. Even when I was little reading them, they really fascinated me, because I think the idea that you can only see them and interact with them if you have had an experience that's changed you in some way, you have to have witnessed, as we say, I think it's the point of death, mm-hmm. someone close to you dying, in order to see them, that it seems remarkable. And I'm wondering if that's a trope in wider folklore again, this idea of only being able to access certain creatures or certain worlds, certain portals, certain layers of reality, if you've had an experience that's changed you. Is she drawing on a broader idea there?
I'm not aware of one that's like that. In a lot of cases, folkloric creatures are only witnessed if they want to be. So they might appear to you, but they might not appear to anybody else. And it might be about kind of how you treat them, if you treat them well or if you treat them badly. But I can't think of another example where it's someone's had a life-changing experience, so suddenly they can see these creatures. So I may be wrong, but that may be another Rowling invention.
Mm, and it talks as well to that kind of almost dichotomy in the books, I guess, where there's this sort of magical world of the magical practice, magic that you can learn, magic that you can perform, that you get to do in school, that you can be taught. And then there's a sort of other layer of magic, which is almost life and death, and thinking about the protection that Lily affords Harry by dying to protect him, or the fact that you can only see the Thestrals if you've witnessed death. It's a sort of a magic that you can only access through experience or through the most extreme moments of living and dying, not through anything that you can practice. And I've always found that interesting about the books, that there's these two almost separate worlds of magic that obviously overlap in terms of how Rowling tells the story. But I think, to me, that feels like her nod to a more ancient kind of magic that she's maybe drawing on in those stories, and a sort of foundation for the novels in a way.
Speaking of that foundation and those kind of ancient origins, is there, you spoke about Dementors having kind of an amalgam of names that we can draw meaning from. Is it the same with Thestral, or is that just totally invented and has no real meaning behind it?
Well, there are lots of death horses in folklore and myth. So lots of horses that if you see them, then they might foretell death, or horses that are the only things able to see malevolent spirits. And they're also used in a lot of world mythologies as the transporter. So they take someone to the afterlife. They take someone to the underworld. So they are kind of heavily associated with death. And then obviously you have Pegasus, the Greek myth, the horse with the wings. Mm-hmm. So that's probably where the inspiration for the winged horse came from, but obviously very, very different. In terms of the word, it just sounds like kestrel.
And they are quite bird-like.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you described in that picture, Anthony, the face is sort of distorted and it is bird-like. They have I imagine that they would weigh nothing like a bird of prey, that they'd have hollow bones.
Yeah.
They feel
looks like that,
substanceless to me. So I think in terms of when we meet the Thestrals, in the first books at least, we have the perspective of the rest of the Hogwarts students and not Harry, in that we get this sense of the carriages being pulled by nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's only as we go deeper into the story and the experiences of some of the characters that we realise that some can see them, I think.
You are a bigger Harry Potter fan than I knew.
This is old knowledge coming up.
Book three, I'd be like, well, I don't even remember what book three was. And I liked them when I read them.
Book three was my first introduction to Harry Potter. I'd poo-pooed it because I was a Lord of the Rings girl. My dad read Lord of the Rings to me when I was in school, and I was like, I'm Lord of the Rings, none of this new Harry Potter rubbish. Then
10-year-old Maddie
picked up the third one and was like, oh, this is actually...
You started with the third
one? Started with the third one and then obviously had to go back.
That
and I was like,
anxious.
What is going on? Yeah, that makes me anxious.
No, I don't
like that's
it.
All out of order. Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about Thestrals and their connection to death. Let's move on now to, I think it's fair to say, a creature that has a little bit more of a foundation in mythology beyond the Harry Potter world, and that's the hippogriffs. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is an extract from the third book, Anthony. The Prisoner of Azkaban.
Okay. Actually, Maddie, it's from chapter 6, called Talons and Tea Leaves.
Oh, you've remembered that off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, it's definitely not in my notes.
It's definitely not right in front of us. Okay. Trotting toward them were a dozen of the most bizarre creatures Harry had ever seen. They had the bodies, hind legs, and the tails of horses, but the front legs, wings, and heads of what seemed to be giant eagles with cruel steel-coloured beaks and large, brilliantly orange eyes. The talons on their front legs were half a foot long and deadly-looking. So, Kerry, these are not necessarily friendly, fluffy creatures, are they?
No, they're dangerous if they want to be, but Hagrid has a big soft spot for them, for one in particular, Buckbeak, who is a character in himself, really. And I guess they're like most wild animals that, you know, you've got to be respectful, and they can turn and they can do a lot of damage if they decide to. But as long as you treat them well, then they will treat you well.
And I love that. Again, it's about bringing something of yourself to the interaction with the magical creature, a little bit like the Thestrals, where it represents the access that you have to them is all about the experience that you've had in your own life. And here you have to bring a sense of, as you say, respect and calm to these creatures. So the combination of a horse, an eagle, a griffin. So what is a
not
griffin?
A hippopotamus. I'm sad that there's not a hippopotamus in there.
I don't even know what that would look like.
I don't know what any of these look like, apart from the pictures.
So the term hippogriff comes from the 16th century.
Oh.
So an Italian poet kind of created the creature hippogriff for a poem as a very fast-flying creature who was born of a mare, a horse, and a griffin. So the griffin has a long history. It goes back to kind of classical times. Pliny the Elder wrote about them as the head of an eagle, but the body of a lion. Mm. So apparently one of these griffins mated with a horse, quite impossibly. And you get the hippogriff. So believed to be able to fly very, very fast, fly around the world. Some very, very early versions describe it as flying to the moon. So yeah, they've got a solid basis in folklore and myth.
So in terms of belief, when it comes to folklore, and I think it's important to establish that folklore has always had a folkloric place in people's mindset. And by that, I mean, people haven't always necessarily believed in these things. They've always occupied a storytelling function. Nonetheless, you mentioned, was it the 17th century or 16th century? 16th century for the hippogriff. Was there any belief system there around that, that this could have actually been an actual creature, or did it solely ground itself in storytelling and myth building?
I think probably by then it was more about storytelling. But when the classical writers were describing them, you know, they were talking about unfamiliar creatures from distant lands. So there probably was belief. And we'll probably come back to this with the basilisk, these creatures that they've never encountered before, and they describe them in a certain way that becomes quite fantastical. So yeah, there will be belief that these creatures just lived a different continent somewhere.
And does their function, thinking specifically about the hippogriff, does its function change from the ancient world through the medieval world, maybe into the early modern world, in terms of certainly the image of it, if not the story as well? Is it changing how people interact with it? Does it have the same adventures, the same function? Do people hunt it and kill it? Do they respect it like they do in Harry Potter? Like, what is it for? How does it appear in people's stories?
In the 16th century, when the hippogriff was first invented from the griffin, it was really used as a steed, something to ride, something to tame, something to capture, and something that could help you become a hero, a lot like Pegasus in Greek mythology. When the classical writers were writing about kind of griffins and things like that, it was more, here's a description of a mysterious creature that some sailors spotted on a distant land. So it's not about kind of human encounters. But yeah, certainly while you go through the medieval period and into the present, it becomes much more about how humans interact, how they can use them. And I know that, you know, Buckbeak is respected and there's a lot of affection for him, but essentially, you know, he is used for riding.
Mm. And he's tamed by Harry in particular. You know, he attacks Malfoy, Harry's nemesis, and there's a sense that Harry is worthy of the relationship with Buckbeak because he's able to bring that respect and to tame him that way. And then later on uses him to ride and to help his uncle escape. That's fascinating, that idea of the hero and the animal, which of course we see in the medieval times in terms of dragons as well, and that sort of conquering, but in that case they usually kill them rather than work with these creatures. And actually Harry becomes a hero, almost a medieval hero then, by being able to tame Buckbeak. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, definitely. So showing yourself worthy of something to be a hero. Yeah.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
We're going to hear a second narrative now, and this is about, I think, my favourite creature from Harry Potter, because I just think the possibilities with it are endless. In a deep, deep dell in Lancashire,
In the northwest of England, trouble was brewing among the hazel and beech trees. A mischievous spirit, a boggart, was plaguing the Cheetham family in their old farmhouse, disturbing their peace with unseen hands and shrill laughter. One winter's eve, young Robert Cheetham dared to jest with the boggart. That night, he and his brother found themselves tangled in their bedsheets, tossed about by an invisible force, while a shrill voice echoed through the house.
Little tyke indeed! Little tyke they sell! Ho, ho, ho! I'll have my laugh now! Ho, ho, ho!
Desperate for peace, the Cheethams moved the children into the cart house, hoping that the boggart would not follow. But it did, and the mischief spread. Bread and butter were snatched from hands, milk was dashed to the ground, and if the youngest child was left alone for a minute, they would soon be screaming in terror. When the torment became too much to bear, the Cheethams made plans to flee their haunted home. But when the day came for them to leave, along with the last of their belongings on a cart, they met a neighbour. The neighbour asked if this was them moving house or flitting, as it was known in those parts. Before the farmer could answer, a familiar voice came out from inside one of the milk pails on the cart.
Aye, aye, neighbour, we're flitting, you see.
Resigned to their fate, the family turned their cart around. A shout out to Anthony's amazing acting skills there.
Thanks very much, guys. Yeah, I was really bad in the quiz, so I decided I'd contribute something.
I would like to just say to listeners that Anthony had to do that because I refused to do the voice. So I'm very grateful. So we've heard a story there, obviously not from Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kerry, give us a sense of where this story comes from. And I have something that I want to add about it, but let's hear, first of all, what is a boggart? Where is this story from? What's its history?
Yeah, I love boggarts. I'm a bit obsessed. I grew up next to a park called Boggart Hall Clough, which that story that you told was about. So boggart's kind of a catch-all phrase for mischievous spirits or hobgoblins or fairies that are either connected to a house or a specific place in the landscape. And they're not overtly evil, but they do tend to behave badly and they cause as much mischief as they can. Sometimes they're described as kind of poltergeists. So you can't see them, you can just hear them moving things around. Other times they're like little squat hobgoblin type creatures. You get a lot of places in the northwest, particularly Lancashire and Greater Manchester, that are named after boggarts, that have their boggart hauntings from history. There is one reference that I found from the 19th century that is similar to J.K. Rowling's description of a boggart that can shapeshift and turn into something that's scary.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a second, because I mean, that's fascinating. But tell us about this example that you found. So that is one of the examples that's closer to her version of it, right?
Yeah, so most of them don't describe the boggart as something that can shapeshift. It is just a creature, it's a type of fairy, a type of mischievous fairy that tends to make life difficult for families or make particular roads unsafe to travel at night. But yeah, this 19th century reference describes it as a creature that can turn into particular animals or into something more fearful. Doesn't describe it as something that can turn into what you fear, but as something that shapeshifts.
That's a Rowling invention later on. That's so interesting. It's fascinating to me that you mentioned the Northwest, because I used to live on the edge of the Yorkshire Moors. And I'm pretty sure that I'm saying this from memory. So if there's anyone listening who lives on the North York Moors, write in and tell me if I've got this right. The story that I just read out, I've heard a similar story told about the North York Moors and a family having to leave because of a fairy. I mean, I don't think the word boggart is used, but, you know, a fairy, an elf, an imp, some kind of mischievous creature in the house has been offended by the second wife of the farmer. The first wife used to leave treats out for them. She's died. The second wife comes in, refuses to leave the butter, the milk, the biscuits, whatever it is, out for these creatures. So they start to play tricks. And when they try and leave, it turns out that the creatures are moving with them. So they just go right back to the farm and have to work out how to get rid of them. So it's fascinating that that's spread across the Pennines, actually, and across the north of England. Let's talk a little bit about the J.K. Rowling version of these. So we meet these Again, I think it's in the third book. Am I right? I think it's in The Prisoner of Azkaban when Harry is subjected to, I mean, questionable teaching methods. Professor Lupin subjects all of his students to a boggart and they have to face quite literally their worst fear. The boggart takes the form of your worst fear and they have to use their magical training to dismiss the boggart and to sort of defeat it. It's a really scary concept, that. And actually, in a school classroom situation, for your schoolmates to see your worst fear and to see you struggle with it, it's really quite dark. It's a dark twist on something that's quite playful, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, fears are so personal. And, you know, some of them you can see really affect the characters. But then he turns it around by having it, you know, turn it into something funny, turn it into something playful. And that's why you get Snape turning into, well, you know, in old lady clothes, and the giant spider with on roller skates. And yeah, obviously Harry's worst fear in the image in my mind from the film of the Dementor coming out.
It's a great scene in the film. Yeah, and I think, so Harry's fear is fear itself because he fears the Dementors, right? Mm-hmm. He fears that feeling of depression and things draining away from him. And then Lupin has to step in when he can't face his fear and the boggart's still coming at him. And of course, we see Lupin's greatest fear is a moon because and it's foreshadowing of the fact that he's a werewolf, which you find out later on in the book. But he turns the moon into a balloon that sort of farts away in the air. And it's, again, thinking about the chocolate as a way to revive someone from experiencing the Dementors, there's this idea of silliness as a counteraction against dark magic, dark ideas, dark monsters.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many deep, dark things in Harry Potter, but that element of whimsy just makes it suitable for children. And also, I think, teaches you how to face those dark parts of life and try and tackle them with something, good memories, or turning it into something that you can laugh at.
And that's what folklore is ultimately about, right? Sort of understanding the world around you and making sense of it in a fantastical way. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's about life and death, it's about love and loss and all of those things, but told in a way that makes it palatable and memorable and so that you can face it, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the most iconic creatures then is probably, and you mentioned this creature already, is the basilisk. Mm-hmm. Obviously in the book, this is a creature that hatches from another chicken egg that's underneath a toad. Why not? And is the king of the serpents. What is the history of this mythological creature? Because there is a history with this one, right? It's another one of those ones that's based in actual mythology.
Yeah, so this is probably one of the oldest creatures in the Harry Potter universe. So it goes back to 1st century AD. Pliny the Elder, a Roman author, was describing basilisks as snakes from Libya, described as a small snake, 12 fingers long, but as one that's venom is so powerful that it doesn't need to bite you. All it needs to do is bite something that's touching you and you will die. So if you stab it with a spear, the poison will go up the spear and into the person. So really fearsome creatures, but they're small. Basilisk means little king. So they're little snakes that are just very, very deadly. Probably cobras. So probably their description of what a cobra was.
So they're based in some kind of truth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. That idea of kind of them being able to kind of maintain an upright position, their ability to kind of spit venom, the fact that they have the hood describing them as a king. So based on real snakes that they were just unfamiliar with during that time in Rome. And then over the centuries, descriptions of them became more and more fantastical. So they became bigger. They became more deadlier. It became like if you heard its voice, then you would die. So J.K. Rowling is certainly not the first person to use the basilisk in this way. So Bram Stoker drew on the basilisk in his description of Dracula, Dracula's gaze. Mm. The basilisk appears in Shakespeare, in Pope, in Shelley. So lots of poets and writers using it. Mm. And J.K. Rowling is one of the more recent ones, make it a big, prominent part of that book and make it huge, actually. So it becomes a lot bigger than those earlier descriptions.
Two things to say. One is, I never understand how the basilisk moves around the castle when it is as big as it is. Mm. It's meant to move around in the plumbing, apparently. I mean, how big are these pipes in Hogwarts? The other thing to say is, just to pick up on this idea of its voice being so powerful, because of course in the Chamber of Secrets, Harry hears the basilisk and he can't work out why no one else can hear it, and it's because, little does he realise, he speaks snake language, which is something that he's accidentally inherited from Voldemort as a baby during the moment when Voldemort tries to kill him, and that's sort of transferred to him. Is Rowling drawing on a particular version of the basilisk and using that voice? Do you think she keeps within the sort of folkloric rules of what its voice can do, or does she draw it out into something and make it her own?
I think she's making her own in that, obviously, because it's a snake, Harry has the ability to hear it. The voice is more just an indication of what it is, I guess. And it torments Harry in a way, but it doesn't do damage. It's the gaze. Mm. And I think there are some references to it in the past. So it's not a J.K. Rowling invention that its gaze will kill or petrify. But I think she was the one who made it, you know, the most prominent feature of the basilisk. It used to be more about its voice and its venom. But obviously its venom is deadly in Harry Potter as well. I think only the tears of a phoenix...
Which,
cure.
Conveniently, of course, Hogwarts has a phoenix, so it's fine.
Happy accident, yeah.
Happy accident, yeah. And we don't, unfortunately, have time to talk about phoenixes in this, actually, because they would be a great subject.
Before we do wrap up, I just want to mention something that I think would be remiss to not have a conversation about this when we're talking about the real monsters of Harry Potter. And I'd be interested to get your take on this, Kerry, because I am not aware of a folklorist in the way that the author of the Harry Potter books has somewhat become in terms of inventing and contributing and advancing folklore. I'm not aware of another folklorist taking on, for some people in society, the mantle of a monster themselves. And I'm wondering what that might say about the power to inform, the power to then disappoint, the light and shade of folklore, and how that's informing real people's lives at this particular time. My point, I suppose, being is that this folklore was something that buoyed so many people at certain periods of time and gave them hope and gave them comfort. And so many of them now, specifically within the LGBT community, obviously enough is what I'm speaking of, so many of them now feel betrayed and themselves dismissed and made to feel potentially like the author did when she describes the depression of the Dementor. And a lot of that is coming from the conversations that the author is having very publicly. I'm just wondering, have you ever come across that immediacy of impact of folklore and folklorists that can have in a very immediate way in today's society at any other point in history? Have you ever seen that impact take on something far more social and far more real? Is that something that we come across?
No. And I think it's the power of social media. Mm. We just don't have this in history. It was a lot easier to separate the art from the artist in the past. Now we know everything about everyone, or at least we know what they want us to see. And suddenly people with a lot of following have a huge platform to air their opinions and to impact people. So no, I think this is something fairly new, and I've never come across a person and their work be so divisive today. You know, considering at its core, it's just stories about a boy. And yet, like I said, in the classroom, whenever anybody mentions Harry Potter or J.K. Rowling, half the room will go, oh, I love it. And the other half will, they hate what she's doing, what she's using her platform for. So this is, I think, new. And I think it's something that authors and folklorists are going to have to think about when they're in the public eye.
I agree.
Yeah.
Kerry, thank you so much for coming on After Dark today and talking to us about these creatures and some of the legacies of the stories that Rowling draws on, but also that she invents herself, actually. It's been completely fascinating. If you want to get in touch with After Dark, you can do so. And we love to hear from you. We love episode suggestions. We love your feedback. We love to hear that you've enjoyed listening. You can email us at afterdark@historyhit.com. You can follow Anthony and I on socials. Tell your friends, tell your family about the show. Please spread the word.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of After Dark. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour.
Don't forget, you can listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe.
And as a special gift, now don't say we never give you anything, you can also get your first 3 months for £1 a month when you use the code AFTERDARK at checkout.